Happy Sunday, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. Our show is being produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener. And our show today has been sponsored by Cabot Cooperative of Vermont. The New England and New York farm families who own Cabot are offering listeners a chance to win some of the world's best cheddar by calling Heritage Radio at 718-497-2128 or emailing info@heritageradionetwork.com. It's an excellent way to start the holidays, and I'll be picking a winner by November 28th. Cabot Creamery is a proud supporter of what Heritage Radio Network is all about. And on Cutting the Curd, we are all about cheese. And today we're brushing up on the state of dairy in Alabama with Alice Birchnow, owner of Sweet Home Farm in Alberta, Alabama. Alice is a true pioneer in the American farmstead cheese movement and has been making and selling raw cow's milk cheeses since 1985. Thanks for being with us, Alice.
Thank you, Anne, for inviting me.
Oh, it's fantastic. Did you hear the theme song? We couldn't resist.
Alabama. Actually, that's kind of funny because the state just changed their license plates to say Sweet Home, so we broke down and got vanity plates.
What do you say?
Our license plates say Sweet Home Cheese now.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, so how... tell me the... I mean... So you named the farm, did you name the farm after the Lynyrd Skynyrd song, or is Sweet Home Alabama a phrase that predates Lynyrd Skynyrd?
Well, I don't know if it predates Lynyrd Skynyrd, but when we first started dairying in western Michigan, before I met my husband, he had called his farm place up there Soggy Bottom Acres, and we didn't think that would probably be a very good name for a dairy. So we changed it when we got started in the dairy business there, and we liked it well enough that we just carried it with us when we moved to Alabama.
And so what prompted the move from Michigan to Alabama?
Well, we were trying to get in the dairy business at a time in the early 80s when there was a huge milk surplus, a lot of commodity cheese being held in storage, and... costing the government a lot of money, and they were actually paying farmers to go out of business. So based on whatever their annual production level was, they would give them an incentive to go out of business, and either the cows had to all go to the slaughterhouse or be exported, and they also had to stay out of the dairy business for at least 5 years. So it wasn't a real... good time to get into business, and because we wanted to be small, they really weren't very supportive of that, and also because we wanted to process, they weren't familiar with that at all. The whole notion of farmstead cheese making was a totally new idea, and it just gave us a lot of resistance, and we just decided with the challenges with the weather and having to keep the cows in the barn all winter, and agricultural taxes were going up at such a phenomenal rate. And it just was kind of a serendipitous thing where I had some friends visiting from Alabama that were in the fishing business at about this whole same time. And about 2 weeks later, my husband Doug was down here looking for property. So it was just a confluence of events that all brought us here. And I grew up in the South, so it feels very natural to be here.
Absolutely. Well, that's amazing. You know, hearing you talk about, you know, dairy in the early 80s, I mean, it's probably had several incarnations of being like that, the situation with an overproduction of milk. But it seems like we're sort of in a similar situation right now. Would you say that, I know you guys operate outside of the commodity business, of course, but would you say that now is kind of a similar time to when you guys first got your start in the dairy business?
Well, the commodity milk business has always been a kind of a roller coaster event. When, you know, the prices go way up, people increase their herds, and everything's great for a couple years.
Yeah. It's like nobody can help it. They just have to, everyone wants to get bigger at the same time.
Right. So when money is good and the pay price is good and farmers are making money and the banks are lending money, and so people just think it's a good time to expand, and then it always kind of, it's just been this way for as long as we've been following the dairy business, you know, expansion, contraction, but the pay price for fluid milk to the commodity market has not kept pace with inflation.
Yeah.
So it's a really tough business to be in.
So you guys chose Farmstead cheese, and like you said, at that time, Farmstead cheese in the U.S. was pretty much unheard of. How did you educate yourself about Farmstead cheese?
It was pretty tough. We didn't have much information. We looked around for books, and all we could really find was the Encyclopedia of Country Living by Carla Emery.
I have that book.
There's a lot of wonderful information in there, but it got us started. And we visited a Michigan State University where they made cheese there, and not too long after that, New England cheesemaking came into being. So it was kind of, we were right on the beginning of the whole artisan cheese movement. So, and took some classes at University of Guelph when we decided to make that transition from homestead to commercial, and just got going. And I still am taking classes and researching, but I think now it's much easier time because people have access to the internet and all the information that's out there, advances in culture technology and more appropriate scale equipment be available. I think it's just a really great time for cheesemakers.
Hey guys, we actually got a question on Twitter for Alice, and they want to know, how do other farmers in Alabama react to your high-quality, value-added product? Is there solidarity or suspicion and jealousy? Basically, you know, how are the other farmers reacting?
Well, you know, when we first moved down here, there was one farmer who every time we saw him in town said, you can't make a living on 40 acres. You can't make a living. So he lived long enough to eat his words. But you know, before, if we told people, other farmers, that we were milking 12, 15 cows, they'd kind of laugh in our face and move away. And now there's, when we started, and for many years, there were only two or three cheese producers in the whole state. Now we have 10 at the last count, and there's three in process of going up. And we have some bottlers. We have our first certified organic dairy.
Wow.
Only one in the state. So I think the attitude now is, yes, we can.
Uh-huh.
And direct marketing is the way to go.
And
because it's not a big dairying state. It's a little more challenging to do things in the south. But our big plus here is that we have grass and we can keep our cows outside all year long.
Now,
so,
can
yeah, it's definitely a groundswell of support now.
That is really... really awesome and encouraging to hear. I was wondering if you can tell our listeners about how you guys market and sell your cheeses, because it's pretty unique compared with some of the other, compared with most of the other cheesemakers in the country.
Right. Well, because we decided to stay small, and, you know, we're kind of a dinosaur in some aspects. We're a mom and pop operation, and we have one part-time person who helps us retail. But because we weren't on a main highway, we thought we could have a mail order business. And then we looked around and we saw that there were no farmers markets. So we said, well, that's not an option. There was absolutely nothing going on in the farmers market arena. So we tried mail order for a little while. We just didn't like it. We didn't like generating all the garbage that goes with mail order, you know, ice packs and shipping and insulation and all that, that trash, really, that you literally generate with shipping. And we just were fortunate enough to choose a location that has a lot of agriculture in the area where there's direct marketing. So people drive from farm to farm to get sweet potatoes or strawberries or fruit or whatever it is. And we're still very conveniently located in that pocket. So they became, we just said, well, what the heck, let's try retailing. And so we got some very wonderful support from media and newspapers and magazines, and people started coming to the farm, and then we just tried to grow our business organically to a point where we could, you know, support ourselves and manage what we can.
Well, it's funny to hear you say that you're a dinosaur. I was looking at the website, the Southern Cheesemakers Guild website last night, and I was like, you know, Alice is my hero. No website, no email address. You know, you guys just do your thing and, you know, and keep it local and keep it close. And I think that is absolutely fantastic.
Well,
that's my dream.
We get a lot of wonderful feedback. You know, I don't have to wonder what happened to the cheese. Did it get lost? Did somebody mess up on the shipping? You know, the customer tastes. You know, we sample liberally. Our customer tastes everything before they buy. We cut everything to order, so it's perfectly fresh. And people have the experience of coming to the farm. So it's a formula that has worked for us.
And now, you guys have been in business since 1985. Do you see still continued growth with people coming out to the farm and
no,
buying cheese?
No, actually, we had to kind of contract our sales hours because for a while we were pretty much holding our production level at about 12 cows, and in 2000 we upgraded all our equipment to make our, you know, the physical work easier, and got better equipment and an automatic stirrer on our vats and a big cooler. So we increased our production at that point by about 50%. So we could milk 15 cows. Mm-hmm. So at that point, we saw that there was still an opportunity to growth, but we didn't want to go there because, you know, we're limited. We only have 40 acres for the dairy and two people who are fast approaching 60. So we decided, well, we're just going to cut back on our sales opportunity hours. So we used to be open 6 days a week, then we cut it back to 4 days a week, and now we're just open 2 days a week. So, and those are pretty intense 2 days, but people still come, and we try to, you know, keep them happy.
Well, I think, you know, it's just amazing. I was actually just yesterday, I went up to Cato Corner Farm, a little dairy farm in Connecticut, and somebody asked them the question, you know, has the economy affected your you know, your farm and your cheese sales? And back, you know, in the beginning of the show, we were talking about the commodity market and how fragile it is and how susceptible it is to all these ups and downs and whims of the market. And Mark, who's the cheesemaker at Cato Corner, said, actually, no, you know, we've experienced the opposite. You know, our farm is going really strong, and we're seeing more and more cheese sales, more people coming to the farm. And I just think it's really amazing to hear stories like yours and like Cato Corners, where, you know, you really have established yourselves as an entity outside of the normal, quote unquote normal, though it's not very normal, economy.
Mainstream.
and it's just, you know, by breaking down barriers between the producer and the end consumer, it's really fantastic, just meaningful work and really and tasty, obviously. So I just think it's incredible as a model for people to consider who are farmers or who are thinking of getting into farming. There are so many different ways that you can make a go of it.
Oh, absolutely. And then, you know, I can see, you know, when we do hay and do field work, how wonderful it is just to, you know, be on a tractor and have the wind in your face and not have to worry about anything. You know, retailing can be very intense. I know you have a retail location, and
mm-hmm.
and you really need to get yourself, put yourself in your consumer's shoes, and give them what they want.
Hey guys, we got another question through email this time, and they want to know what the greatest challenges of being a cheesemaker are.
Well, you know, as we get older, it's the physical labor, and we really have decided that at that point that was one of the reasons why we didn't want to grow. And you have to be a good people manager if you do want to grow, and we're not great at that either. And we know that. So I think, you know, physically it's a very demanding work, and you have to love it and not mind getting your hands dirty and be willing to make the financial investment and take any of the assumed risks that you would get into with any business.
Now, how about technically, Alice? When you come up against technical issues when you're making a cheese, is that a challenge, and how do you deal with it?
Well, that's my favorite part. You know, my background that was in nutrition. I worked as a clinical nutritionist for a few years, so I really enjoy the technical part. So I've done a lot of research on cultures and that whole aspect of acidification and how different cultures and different acidification profiles can influence your cheese, and that to me is the most fun part of cheese making, the R&D, biochemical aspect of how things work and how they transform as you go along, and you watch that grass turn into milk, and then your cheesemaker takes over and turns that milk into cheese, and how it changes through the seasons, and just a really enlightening experience.
And never-ending, kind of the different nuances of it.
Different going on every single day, so I think that's what makes it so fun, because if you weren't having fun doing this, it would be way too much work.
Absolutely. Now, what kind of cheeses do you guys make? What are the ranges, the range of your cheeses?
Well, we do probably about 12 or 14 different kinds. You know, a Jack and Gouda, and we do a lot of seasoned varieties because our customers like that. We do a blue, we do some Alpine styles, some Italian grating cheeses. We do a cheese fudge, which is kind of a dessert type of thing, and couple of house specialties. We do a Perdido and a feta, all at least 15 different kinds.
Wow. It's making me hungry. Cheese fudge. I've never had that before. I want to come down and try that.
You have to make a chocolate cheesecake, so get you in the right mindset.
Well, I think it's time for us to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk more with Alice Bertineau of Sweet Home Farm in Alabama and hear more about milk and the state of cheese in that state. And we're back on Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. My guest today is Alice Bertineau. If you have questions for us, please email info@heritageradionetwork.com or tweet them to the Twitter feed @HRNUpdates. We were talking about how much I dislike technology, but those kinds of things are kind of actually fun. People from all over end up, you know, commenting on the shows and bring in their questions, so we do appreciate it. So Alice, can you tell us a little bit about the Southern Cheesemakers Guild? The South isn't typically an area where people think about tons of cheese, but there is an ever-increasing number of cheesemakers in the South.
Yes, the guild, most of actually the members in the guild are based in North Carolina, and North Carolina has a really strong cheesemaking community. A lot of the operations are very small, and I think some of the incentive there was when they were encouraging farmers to get out of the tobacco business. So they had some money appropriated for people to get into some other types of alternative agriculture, even though none of the cheesemakers I know were used to be tobacco farmers. But there's this whole sense of looking for other avenues in the agricultural community, a different way to make a living. So most of the cheesemakers are concentrated there. It's a pretty loose organization. We have a meeting like every other year, and we communicate online. It's a great group. When we do get together, we have we try to have a little workshop event and drink some wine and eat lots of cheese and just enjoy each other's company.
Well, it's fantastic that those organizations exist, because knowledge sharing, I feel like, is one of the things that makes American cheesemakers such a unique group of people. The fact that everyone's so willing to share pretty much everything they know with everybody else. I mean, you've probably been a great mentor to many cheesemakers.
You know, when I started, there wasn't that many people you could ask questions of, and I think we all kind of had to share the little information that was out there. I was fortunate enough go to the very first American Cheese Society meeting at Cornell. So that was a really exciting time, because people from all over the country came and were looking for answers, and it was kind of fun to be in on the ground level of that.
And what year was that, the first ACS meeting?
Well, it's over 25 years.
Wow. Wow. Just thinking about, I mean, I saw you at the American Cheese Society in Seattle this summer.
Yeah.
And just thinking about, I think there are probably 2,000 people there or something crazy like that.
I think the membership now is like 1,200.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's grown quite a bit. So for many, many years, it was pretty stable at about 400. But I'd say the last 5 years or so, it's been phenomenal in growth.
Now, what about, so are there any other sort of festivals or sort of events for cheese people, cheesemakers in the South or in Alabama?
Not specifically for cheese, but whenever there is a festival in the area, we have a big shrimp festival, and there's a local sausage festival in our community, and whenever those festivals are happening, we always see a big influx of business on those days. But nothing specific for dairy in the South, I think, because the South doesn't have a tradition of dairying. Rural electrification really didn't become widespread till the 1940s. So I think most of the cheese-making avenues were going up in cooler climates. There's not really a tradition of cheesing and making in the South, so a lot of the seniors in the area like to tell me how their mothers used to make cottage cheese and then hang it out on the clothesline to drip. So that was their home-scale cheese making.
That was the home-scale cheese making.
Yes.
Cool. Very cool. Well, as far as your cows go, though, you said, you know, an advantage to your area is that you do have grass all year round. So is it a good place to raise dairy cows?
Well, you know, they get pretty stressed in the summer heat, but we try to give them lots and lots of shade. We have a really nice grove of pecans where they can hang out and drink water, but we love that they can be outside all the time. We have, in fact, Doug just finished planting for winter pastures. So we have some cool weather grasses and legumes that are already up. And they'll continue to grow right up through May, and our really prime grasses are like from the end of January through the end of May. So we really have just a brilliantly yellow milk at that time. Right now we're supplementing with a little hay. We get hay from a neighbor who lives less than 2 miles away, because we've had We actually had a light early frost already, but the winter grasses aren't quite fully up yet, so the cows are eating a little hay. But yeah, they get exercise and they're outside, so no manure to move around. They move it all themselves.
let them do the heavy lifting. I like that. Well, so I know something that I wanted to talk to you about was the issue of raw milk. You make raw milk cheeses, and you're obviously a raw milk advocate. But it seems like, you know, there have been a few instances lately of some people having a hard time with raw milk. Can you sort of, I don't know, give our listeners an idea of what the climate is like in Alabama surrounding raw milk?
For fluid raw milk, you would have to go through the Department of Agriculture to get a license to sell pet food. Hmm. And if you have a grade A license, you cannot also have a pet food license because they don't want grade A producers selling raw milk. So, and to my knowledge, there are no licensed pet food milk producers. That's the climate in Alabama.
Okay, so that's pretty cut and dry. So they're not interested in having people sell fluid raw milk. And what about for you as a cheesemaker? Have you encountered difficulties?
With my health regulators?
Yeah.
No, actually, because there's a dairy deficit in the South, well, they were very welcoming here. I have a good working relationship with them. They were supportive. I always get very high scores on my inspections and have had a good support system from them. So I can't complain about my dairy inspectors at all. They've been really good to work with.
Well, that's good. That's encouraging to hear. Well, it's funny. I'm thinking about, you know, at this year's American Cheese Society conference, there was a lot of talk about terroir and the importance of terroir in cheesemaking. And on the one hand, I'm really, really excited about it because I feel like terroir is, you know, sort of the loose translation is taste of place from the French. And it's about, you know, making milk from, you know, the grass and your land and then turning that milk into cheese that, you know, has a specific flavor due to that. But I feel like, you know, as there's another side to terroir, which is the economy and the people and the food traditions behind it, meaning that, you know, in France and Italy and in a bunch of other places, terroir has grown up over hundreds of years.
Right.
As cheeses have kind of evolved with, you know, the climate, with the, you know, local agricultural practices. And so I feel like we're still pretty far away from getting there. But a good building block to getting there would be the greater acceptance and encouragement of raw milk cheese production, because raw milk is kind of the building block, you know, of those flavors. So I don't know, what do you think about about terroir?
Well, I think the consciousness of the American culture is everybody wants to do their own thing, and in these AOC or EOP region in Europe, terroir is tightly defined, the areas is tightly defined, and the milk and the procedure for cheesemaking and everything is very well defined, but all the cheesemakers in that area are producing one. So I think that's something very foreign to the American consciousness, because everybody wants to do their own thing. I'm going to make this, and I'm going to call it my own name. And another person might copy that style, but put a little twist on it and call it something else. So I see that.
But raw milk is
very difficult to get Americans to co-op into making all the same kind of cheese.
It's true. Well, actually, we have one more call in. I think it sounds like the caller's on the line. Are you with us, caller?
Yes, I am. I'd like to say a couple things. First of all, great show. Second of all, Anne, you know, you definitely, cheese and sustainable agriculture needs more beautiful people in it, and you definitely uphold that and draw attention to good things. And the third thing I'd like to say is there's this idea also I've had of tetoir. Tet being the French for head, and it's like knowledge of a people or a person or a place, you know, and I think the knowledge of the people, you know, terroir talks of the soil, tetoir talks of a kind of knowledge base that is built through pioneering products or farms like yours in Alabama. So I just thought it was an interesting new term that kind of conveys the knowledge of a head, of a hands, of the seasons, you know, in a specific place.
Yeah, no, definitely. Thanks. Thanks for calling. I think that, you know, maybe that has more resonance even than you know, the idea of terroir, because right now, like Alice, you were saying, it's more about individuals, and individuals kind of honing their craft and their ideas. And then we're kind of seeing how that's all going to play out. But, yeah, it's a tricky, but very interesting, can of worms.
Right. I think if there was a region that wanted to do it, it would take, you know, some very dedicated, cheese makers and farmers to get on board with that. I know one incident in Vermont where, you know, the Putnams at Thistle Hill have kind of set up another farm to produce their cheese. But, you know, just by his sense of place, his cheese is a little different from the Putnams. And so I think, you know, they cooperate. But still, it's an expression of how the cheesemaker is working their milk, and everything can be different just from farm to farm.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, for me, yeah, I just feel like since there is so much individuality and so much difference in style of cheese, and like you said, even two cheesemakers making the same cheese on two different farms, I feel like raw milk could be a real rallying cry, you know, because that's something that would definitely, you know, influence, you know, have a great influence on our dairy and cheese landscape. Yeah, it doesn't have to be as dialed in and as specific as those European traditions.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so what are your plans for the farm? Do you guys have any exciting things coming up this fall, or?
Well, right now we're just people are starting to get in a holiday mood. We had some challenges this year because of the oil spill on the Gulf. We're only 10 miles from the Gulf, so a lot of people and individuals were impacted by that. So we're still not back to 100%, but we were much more fortunate than some other folks. We're happy that's not front and center in the news every day anymore.
Yeah.
But that was a big impact on this area.
Now, would you say, is your area a place where a lot of people would come visit from other places?
It is, actually. We weren't so aware of that when we moved here, but yeah, it's a big tourist area.
Mm, okay.
And we have tourists, a different category of tourists at different times of year. We get a lot of Midwesterners in the winter months, and then spring break, and then summer beach, and then fall for central. Southerners like to come in the fall or in October, so it's pretty much a good tourist season here all year round.
Wow, that's really interesting. So, yeah, interesting to think about how an incident like that could affect an industry that has no specific tie to the sea,
right.
But, you know, just proximity.
Right.
Yeah. I think we're just about out of time here, but thank you so much for taking time out of your Sunday to talk with us and be on the show.
It was my pleasure.
And I look forward to seeing you at next year's American Cheese
Great.
Society Conference.
Montreal,
here we come.
Okay. Thank you, Anne.
Thanks, Alice, and we'll see you next week on Cutting the Curd.